and hold hands in twos, or something like that. And just as we're gathering together again, very remiss, but forgot to say hello to some guests from a long way away over there, Doug's mum and brother visiting us. So it's great to see you. Great that you could be here. Sorry, earlier on we didn't give you that welcome, but you're very welcome. Very, very welcome. And I suppose I ought just to mention as well, keep our treasurer happy that on the 20th of March, which is a few weeks away, but 20th of March is our gift day. You'll find information about that in... Sorry. You'll find information about that in Newslink. The new version of which is out today. Not having a good day, am I? Right. Well, a long time ago, in a time that we parents like to call BC, before children, you tend to have a lot more time to do things. Have you noticed that, any of you? One of the things I used to love to do, which I haven't done for years and years and years, is write music, compose music. You just never seem to have time with children. And I used to do a lot of it, writing songs and things. And I remember writing a piece of music which, to me, sounded like you'd just gone to the zoo and you were watching the elephant enclosure. So I called it Fooling Around with Eddie. I don't know why. One of the memories I have of this fairly banal piece of music is that Emily liked to dance to it. So I still was writing when Emily was young. Probably gave up when the second one came along. It gets progressively harder, doesn't it? But Emily used to love to dance to this. I nearly called it Falling Around with Emily because she just loved to dance. And I have that vivid recollection of her dancing. And it reminds me that children are kind of naturally joyful creatures, aren't they, generally? They're very resilient. They're wonderful. They bring such joy into our lives. And children have that habit of being able to celebrate the joy of living in a way that somehow, when you get a bit older like me, you can tend to lose it a little bit. The guy who wrote the book that we're following in these weeks, he has a son, I think, called Mallory. Is Mallory a boy or a girl? These Americans, I don't know whether Mallory is. It. Anyway, has a child called Mallory. It's going to be a long morning, folks. Long, long morning. He noticed this in his own child. I'll just read a little quote from him. He says, on a particular occasion, oh, that's right, Mallory was in the bath and got out of the bath and started dancing around. You know, children just do that kind of thing, don't they? And he says, on this particular occasion, I was irritated. Mallory, hurry, I prodded. So she did. It's a she. Say so. So she did. She began running in circles faster and faster, chanting, dee-da-day, 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 more rapidly. No, Mallory, that's not what I mean. Stop with the dee-da-day stuff and get over here so I can dry you off. Hurry! And then she asked a profound question. Why? I had no answer, he said. I had nowhere to go, nothing to do, no meetings to attend, no sermons to write. I was just so used to hurrying. So preoccupied with my own little agenda, so trapped in this rut of moving from one task to another, that here was life, here was joy, here was an invitation to the dance right in front of me, and I was missing it. So I got up, and Mallory and I did the dee-da-day dance together. She said I was pretty good at it too for a man my age. And that in their family has become known as the dee-da-day moment, the dee-da-day attitude to life, the dee-da-day dance. And it sounds good, doesn't it? And I have a lot to learn about dee-da-day. You know, last week we were talking about the discipline of slowing down and of solitude in response to being in a busy world and hurrying all the time. I need to learn that there is joy. In fact, joy is at the heart of God's plan for being human. Right there in the centre. And I suspect that probably I seriously misunderstand, or underestimate rather, God's capacity for joy and joyful living. And I think that we can be a bit like that, can't we? I want to read from Isaiah 55 because it's such a wonderful passage. which speaks of the goodness of God. We sung about that table laden with good things that God shares with those. Isaiah 55, verse 1 to 13. These are quite famous verses. You might recognize some of them, including the ones we sang just before our refreshments. Isaiah chapter 55, verse 1. Come, all of you who are thirsty, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk, without money and without cost. Why spend money on what is not bread, and your labour on what does not satisfy? Listen to me, and eat what is good, and your soul will delight in the richest of fare. Give ear, and come to me. Hear me, that your soul may live. I will make an everlasting covenant with you, my faithful love promised to David. See, I have made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander of the peoples. Surely you will summon nations you know not, and nations that do not know you will hasten to you because of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has endowed you with splendor. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the evil man his thoughts. Let him turn to the Lord, and he will have mercy on him, and to our God, for he will freely pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return to it without watering the earth and making it bud and flourish, so that it yields seed for the sower and bread for the eater, so is my word that goes out from my mouth. It will not return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it. You will go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills will burst into song before you, and all the trees of the fields will clap their hands. Instead of the thorn bush will grow the pine tree, and instead of briars, the myrtle will grow. This will be for the Lord's renown, for an everlasting sign which will not be destroyed. Isaiah 55. God is speaking through Isaiah, who wrote it all down, who prophesied to a people who were dispirited, demoralized, people who were no longer living in their homes. They had been taken away from all they knew into exile. All they wanted to do was go home, to back to the life that they knew. And through Isaiah, God is saying, don't despair. Don't lose hope. Because your God is a God of life, of celebration, of joy, of love. Your God is a God who wants you to live. And so very often we can be exactly like that. We can live in the moment and experience very little joy because we're not terribly good at it. We're not terribly practiced at it, at least some of us. Children are good. We've established that, haven't we? Children are very good at this. They have abounding vitality. They're free in spirit. They have a fierce and free way about them. They always say, do it again, don't they? Have you ever played with a child, a young child? Do it again. Oh, all right. One more time. Do it again. Until you actually, your back breaks, you know. They're always physical. They want to walk up you or something, don't they? And that sort of game. Do it again. 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 Grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in the kind of monotony of a child playing the same game again and again and again. But, you know, perhaps God is. I love a passage in G.K. Chesterton where he explores this whole idea of God being very childlike. He says it's possible that every morning God says, do it again to the sun. And every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be the laws of nature that keep it happening exactly the same way. It may be because God is there constantly saying, do it again. And do it again. and do it again. That's a wonderful way to look at how the world works. In contrast to the idea that it's kind of mechanical and fixed and just goes on and on and on without outside interference, God is saying, do it again. It may not be automatic necessity that daisies all look alike. They do, don't they? I mean, you know, can anybody tell the difference between daisies, one daisy and another? You'll probably tell me, some of you, that they are all different, like fingerprints and snowflakes and things, but they all look the same to me. But maybe it's that God makes every single one of them separately and he's never got tired of making them. It may be that he's the eternal appetite of infancy, says G.K. Chesterton. We have sinned, he says, and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. I like that, don't you? We have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. I have to say, I've borrowed all this. It's not me, but someone that it appears in John Ortberg's book. He says, imagine Genesis. We all know the first bit of the Bible fairly well, don't we? He says, imagine Genesis if God approached his work the way we do. In the beginning, it was 9 o'clock, so God had to go to work. He filled out a requisition to separate light from darkness. He considered making stars to beautify the night and planets to fill the skies, but thought it sounded like too much hard work. And besides, thought God, that's not my job. So he decided to knock off early and call it a day. And he looked at what he had done and he said, it'll have to do. On the second day, God separated the waters from the dry land, and he made all the dry land flat, plain, and functional, so that, behold, the whole earth looked like Essex. He thought about making mountains and valleys and glaciers and jungles and forests, but he decided it wouldn't really be worth the effort. And he looked at what he had done that day and he said, it'll have to do. And God made a pigeon to fly in the air, and a carp to swim in the waters, and a cat to creep upon dry ground. And God thought about making millions of other species of all sizes and shapes and colours, but he couldn't really drum up any enthusiasm for any other animals. In fact, he wasn't too crazy about the cat. Besides, it was almost time for the late show. So God looked at all he had done and God said, it'll have to do. And at the end of the week, God was seriously burned out. So he breathed a big sigh of relief and said, thank me it's Friday. Now Genesis is nothing like that, is it? Thankfully Genesis is nothing like that. In fact, when you look in Genesis, God saw that it was good, and it was good. Indeed, it was very good. On the first day, God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. The first day was a D-Day day, and God did a little dance. And the next day, God said to the light, do it again! And the light did it again, and God danced again. And it's gone on every day, down to this one, down to this morning of the day, or the day that you were born, or today when you got up. When you're hearing this. So it is with God. That's who God is. That's what he's like. But we're not terribly like that. For at least in my case, I have sinned and grown old. And our Father, he is younger than we. God is the most joyful being in the universe. If you grew up, and some of us did grow up with the idea of God like a policeman or a strict teacher or something like that, we've missed out on one of the most important aspects of who God is. It was there in that passage from Isaiah. The wonderful grace and love and generosity and bounty of God. You come. It was full, packed full of symbolism and metaphor and all the rest of it, wasn't it? But coming and buying food without money. Who wouldn't want to do that? The choicest food, the best. Come and share in it, even though we don't deserve it. Now, let's be clear. God also understands sadness and sorrow. Jesus, one of his names was Man of Sorrows, acquainted with grief. But you see, the sorrow of God, it's a bit like the anger of God. They're temporary. That's temporary response to this world in its fallen state, this world not being like it's meant to be. God isn't permanently sorrowful. He isn't permanently angry. Soon, that sorrow will be banished forever from his heart on the day that the world is set right by what Jesus is doing and what we do alongside Jesus. Joy is basic It's God's basic character. It's his default position. It's eternal destiny for him and us. He wants creation to mirror that joy. The psalmist speaks of the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom from his wedding canopy and like a strong man runs its course across the sky with joy. That's a lovely picture, isn't it? The whole of creation can mirror God's joy. And the whole of the Bible talks about the need for joy in our lives. Not just any old joy, but only the kind of joy that comes through knowing God and knowing our place in the world and knowing how we fit in with that. The joy that characterizes God. When Jesus had been teaching his followers about the need for obedience, he said his aim was that they should be filled with joy. Not just any kind of joy. He said, I've said these things that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. It's not just happiness. It's not just having a good time. It's the joy that only God can give. One writer put it this way, to miss out on joy is to miss out on the reason for your existence. C.S. Lewis said, joy is the serious business of heaven. And Paul in the Bible wrote, rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice. What's interesting is the Bible talks about joy in the non-optional sort of category. There are certain things, you know, that aren't that important when it comes down to it, in terms of how we live as Christians, but joy isn't one of them. You can't choose not to have joy. Joy is a command. Joylessness is a serious sin. Now, if I asked you to put your hands up if you knew a few joyless Christians, I bet all of us probably would put our hands up. Maybe we wouldn't. I won't ask you. It's embarrassing to do stuff like that, isn't it? But some Christians give you that impression. Some of them even talk about a deep joy in the Lord, but it never gets anywhere near the face, does it? It never gets anywhere near their life and what they enjoy to do. James Joyce wrote the book A Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man. And in that book, Stephen Dedalus, the hero, decides not to become a priest. He has a vision of what would happen to his face, how it would become like the faces of other religious people he knew. And he describes it like this: a mirthless mask reflecting a sunken day, sour-favoured and devout, shot with pink tinges of suffocated anger. Have you met anybody with a face like that? Maybe it's my face like that, at least some of the time. There is someone in the universe who wants you to live without that kind of joy, but it's not God. Francis de Sales wrote this: the evil one is pleased with sadness and melancholy because he is himself sad and melancholy and will be so for all eternity. Hence he desires that everyone should be like himself. A few weeks ago, we read from Nehemiah. I don't know if you remember that, those of you who were here on that occasion. And the Bible, in the Old Testament, often God's people are told to do things like pray and to fast, keep a fast to the Lord. But their celebrations, their feasts, were something else. And in this passage in Nehemiah, Nehemiah said to his church, to his congregation, to the people, this day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn or weep. Go your way, eat the fat and drink sweet wine and send portions of them to those for whom nothing is prepared. For this day is holy to the Lord. Do not be grieved, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. It's a command. If Nehemiah was here, he'd say, you must go home and enjoy, eat, celebrate. Next Sunday, we're having a service where we're asking everyone to come a bit earlier, and we're going to start with, it's only toast, I know, but we're trying to do things a bit differently so we can come together. We want to celebrate our lives and all that's good about our God. And you can become a joyful person, even if you're not. Now, some of you are. Please, don't be offended. Some of you are amazingly joyful people already. Well done. But for those of us who need the discipline, at least some of the time, of celebrating and becoming more joyful, then you can do it with God's help. We wouldn't be commanded it if it were not possible. But it is something like we were looking at last week that is a learned skill. Now, last week we talked about solitude, and some of you might look at me and say, I spend so much time on my own, I'm good at that, I have to do it anyway. Well, that's great. This is why we're looking at a whole range of these things. This is almost the opposite. Do you know, I know some folks, some Christian people who seem to withdraw from others. And it's something we need to work at. So that when we come together as God's people, we enjoy being together. We celebrate. It's not a pain. We don't have to endure it. But we have to work at it. How are we to do this? Well, first of all, I need to take responsibility. We all need to take responsibility. Okay, it's not down to your friend or your parents or your spouse or your children or your boss. Your joy is your responsibility. We're all good at playing the oh, if only game. If only this were different. If only that were different. If only so and so would stop being like that. If only this. We take responsibility. It can be done. We might have to fight for it, but it can be done. I think that's the reason we see so much emphasis in the Old Testament on all these feast days and so on. To give space in the life of God's people to celebrate. Times of feasting were to be transforming experiences. Celebration involves activities that bring pleasure. Gathering with people we love and care about. Eating, drinking. So important. That's why we do it in church. We do more of it. Singing, dancing. Spiritual celebration means doing them while reflecting on the wonderful God who's given us such a wide range of wonderful gifts to enjoy. And we mustn't leave that out. We often think discipline is abstinence from things, don't we? Abstinence from things we like. Lent is coming up. That's good too. We need to take that into consideration. Self-discipline. But here, Nehemiah, in Nehemiah 8, has commanded people to set aside time to revel and enjoy. Eating the fat, choice food. It's a discipline, as much as fasting is a discipline. We expect a prophet, don't we, to tell us to eat locusts and Brussels sprouts and or maybe nothing. But Nehemiah is handing out the right to go and eat the equivalent of as much chocolate, not on as much as you can, that's gluttony, hang on, we do that a bit later. Caviar, I don't know what it is for you. Incidentally, hedonism is quite a different thing. Eating to excess, doing all things to excess, doing things simply for the pleasure is hedonism, and it's not what we're talking about here. This is about celebrating the good gifts of God and enjoying what he's given. Well, you can tell the difference because hedonism follows the law of diminishing returns. Okay, so what we did yesterday no longer satisfies us any longer, and we have to do more in order to get the same kind of return. And our capacity for joy diminishes. So the thing inside us which is meant for joy actually gets smaller and smaller. So we need more of it, and we feed it, and we end up just a pale caricature of the people we're meant to be. Celebration, that's not celebration. When we celebrate, we exercise our ability to see and to feel goodness in the simplest things. We take delight today in something perhaps we wouldn't have even noticed yesterday. Our capacity for joy increases. And we don't need the excess. We simply enjoy the good things. So, a few pointers. And again, you'll pick up on some of these things in groups if you're meeting in house groups this week. We need to start with today. We need to start with today. In the Psalms, we're told, "This is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it." Doesn't say, "Yesterday was God's day. How happy I was." Although that may be true. Doesn't say, "Tomorrow will be a great day. I'll just endure this one until then." This day, today, with all its shortcomings, with all the pressures, with all the problems, this day is the day the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. We'll make this one a D-Day day. We all live with that illusion, the if-only game, that it'll come one day. The Bible tells us, no, it's today. It's now. So how can I do that? And perhaps a question comes into mind. With all the suffering in the world, with the pain in the world, how could we possibly celebrate? What joy could there possibly be? Is it right? in a world of hunger, in a world of injustice, in a world where we suffer so much grief. Well, there's a clue for me in this, at least, with the fact that the people who live closest to suffering often seem to be the most joyful people. It was said, I don't know if it's true, I didn't meet her, but it's said of Mother Teresa that instead of being overwhelmed by the suffering around her, she glowed with joy as she went about her ministry of mercy. And that despite the fact that she often doubted where God was in it all. We've read that since she died, haven't we? She glowed with joy. That's what they wrote about her. One of the English officers that was imprisoned in Flossenbürg with Dietrich Bonhoeffer said this: Bonhoeffer always seemed to me to spread an atmosphere of happiness and joy over the least incident, and profound gratitude for the mere fact that he was alive. If we really want to experience the kind of joy God has, it almost seems that we need to be imprisoned. We need to have our liberty taken away. We need to start suffering. Richard Wurmbrand was another, wasn't he? Spoke of that incarceration and the appalling circumstances, and yet the joy that they felt. True joy, it turns out, comes to those who've devoted their lives to something more than their own personal happiness. Because we're not talking about personal happiness. We're talking about the joy that only God can give, that our joy might be complete. So perhaps one test of real joy, authentic joy, is its compatibility with sorrow, compatibility with pain and suffering. Joy in this world is always joy in spite of the things that are around us. Karl Barth said, it's a defiant nevertheless. A defiant nevertheless. I will rejoice in the Lord. And if we don't rejoice today, then we're not rejoicing at all. If we wait until conditions are perfect, until everything is right, we will still be waiting when we die. This is the day that the Lord has made. What else can we do? Well, a good thing is to sort of check out people who we might describe as joy carriers. Do you know the kind of person I mean? There are people who seem to have got this, don't they? People who really do revel and appreciate the wonders of life, despite everything. And we need to find people like that and learn from them and stick with them. And then there are other folks who have, it seems, rejected joy and decided to become victims. Do you know the kind of person I mean here? They don't want us to be particularly joyful either. Someone described this kind of person as like black holes in outer space. They just suck the joy right out of you. I like to say, for those who've read Harry Potter, they're like Dementors. But hey, let's be honest here. That will happen if we allow it. We know people like that, and we have to love folks for who they are. We all have to endure a few joy-destroying people in life, and we love them as best we can, but we have to be careful that they don't shape the kind of people that we are. And we have to be careful that we don't become that kind of person to those around us. Perhaps the least surprising thing you read in the Bible anywhere is in Proverbs. It says this: smiling faces make us happy. Try it. Maybe not now, because it's embarrassing turning to the person next to you and smiling, but try it somewhere else. Smile at someone, see what happens. They'll either smile back or they'll pull a face and think, what a weirdo. But actually, smiling makes you happy. We need to identify people who can carry the joy that God has so that we perhaps get a bit of a whiff of it and learn. We need to find people around us and find time. To find time. Find time today. Bonhoeffer wrote that his meals in prison made an opportunity to exercise the discipline of joy. So how about making a mealtime part of your D-Dar Day experience, doing it slightly different, spending slightly longer over it, setting it up as a bit of a banquet. It doesn't have to be lots of food, but just making it a special moment. Or say, take a day and making it your D-Dar Day and doing things that are just simple gifts of God which you enjoy. This is where we got the idea of holiday from, wasn't it? Holy day, the feast days that God commands to keep holy days, to celebrate his goodness, doing things which refresh our spirit, surrounding ourselves with beauty. And as we do it, giving thanks to God for his wonderful, wonderful goodness. What a fantastic God to have thought of these things and to have offered them so freely, as he says in Isaiah. Some of us went to see C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters performed by the Saltmine Theatre Company a couple of weeks back. In the book, Uncle Screwtape says this, the devil writing to his nephew, the junior devil, advice on how to keep Christians from being happy and joyful. Never forget, he said, that when we are dealing with any pleasure in its healthy and normal and satisfying form, we are in a sense on the enemy's ground. The enemy is God. It's all turned around, isn't it? I know we have won many a soul through pleasure. All the same, it is his invention, not ours. He made the pleasures. All our research so far has not enabled us to produce one. All we can do is encourage the humans to take pleasure, the pleasures which our enemy has produced at times or ways or in degrees which he has forbidden. An ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure is the formula. To get the man's soul and give him nothing in return, that is what really gladdens our Father's heart. That's the Father down below in this case. So we want to celebrate. And next week I want us to come together, and it's a bit do-it-yourself next Sunday. I want us to celebrate our lives and the good things about our lives together and encourage one another. We need to discipline our minds to see things from God's perspective and not just from ours. The New Testament writers were very good at encouraging us to do that. And if, as we sort of conclude this morning, you're still struggling, and I don't blame you if you are, because life can be so cruel and difficult, how can we build in these D-Day Day moments? How can we develop a D-Day Day attitude when we struggle so much and when we experience so much pain? How can we celebrate when things go badly wrong? I'll tell you a story. A story that a chap called Robert Fulghum writes about in a book about a wedding. A wedding that was produced on such an epic scale by what can only be described as an unhinged character known as MOTB, Mother of the Bride. The MOTB. The logistics of this wedding, the logistics from an 18-piece brass band and wind ensemble to 24 bridesmaids, groomsmen, flower, petal throwers, ring bearers. These were of a scale usually seen only during a military invasion of a small country. It was that kind of wedding. This is a true story. But the plans were working until the climactic moment of the procession of the bride. The bride, let me read to you. She had been dressed for hours, if not days. No adrenaline was left in her body, left alone with her father in the reception hall of the church, while the march of the maidens went on and on and on and on. She had walked along the tables laden with gourmet goodies and absent-mindedly sampled first the little pink and yellow and green mints. Then she picked through the silver bowls of mixed nuts and ate the pecans, followed by a cheese ball or two, some black olives, a handful of glazed almonds, a little sausage with a frilly toothpick stuck in it. In fact, you could have a D-Day Day moment. I'm just going home and sticking cocktail sticks in sausages, because you never have that set at parties, do you? Sorry, just occurred to me. A couple of shrimps blanketed in bacon, a cracker piled with liver pate. To wash it down, a glass of pink champagne. Her father gave it to her to calm her nerves. And what you noticed as the bride stood in the doorway was not a dress, but a face. White. For what was coming down the aisle was a living grenade with the pin pulled out. The bride threw up just as she walked by her mother. I'm quoting to you from this from the book now. And by threw up, I don't mean a polite little lady like up into a handkerchief. She puked. There's no nice word for it. I mean she hosed the front of the church, hitting two bridesmaids, the groom, a ring bearer, and me. Only two people were seen smiling. One was the mother of the groom, and the other was the father of the bride. Fulghum explains how they pulled themselves together for a much quieter, gentler ceremony than the one they had planned. and how everybody cried, as people are supposed to do at weddings, mostly because the groom held the bride in his arms through the whole ceremony, and no groom ever kissed a bride more tenderly than he. But here's the point of this story. 10 years later, everyone was invited back for another party to celebrate not the wedding, but the disaster. They watched the whole thing on 3 TV sets. The mother of the bride, the MOTB, had 3 video cameras running concurrently to make a video. And guess what? This party was thrown by the mother of the bride herself. How could they all rejoice when everything had gone wrong? Because in spite of all the mess, in spite of all that had gone wrong, the bride still got the groom. At the end of the day, that was really all that mattered. The bride got the groom. It was a D-Dar day. How is it possible to be a joyful person in a pain-filled world? We need to look at the promise that comes right at the end of the Bible, very near the end. Let us rejoice and exult and give him the glory, it says in Revelation. For the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. In the story, in God's story, heaven gets the bride. The bride is the church of Jesus Christ. It's the people of God in this symbolic language of Revelation. The joy that is in store for God's people is so great that the only image that can do it justice is the joy between a lover and his beloved. And we're promised the wedding to end all weddings, the greatest wedding this earth will ever have seen. Even the best wedding we've been to will be a dim shadow of the wedding between God and his people. God will then dance with his people, his bride. Joy will reign undiminished, uninterrupted. There will be no more sorrow. There will be no more suffering. And then the words of the prophet who was trying to express the inexpressible will come true. You will go out with joy and be led forth in peace. It's as though the mountains and the hills will burst into song and the trees will be clapping their hands. And John in Revelation says, God will dwell with them. He will dwell with them as their God. They will be his people. And God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eye. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. That's the dawn of the greatest ever D-Dar day. The D-Dar day that will never end. And you and I are called to live in those D-Dar moments right now in anticipation of all that God is doing and will do. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I confess before you that there are many moments in my days when I'm not a particularly good D-Dar person. And I ask you to forgive me. Forgive us, Lord, when we have grown old, not just in body, but in attitude, in spirit. When we have lost that childlike capacity for wonder and joy and exaltation in the simplest of things. That we've grown tired of doing it again instead of wallowing in the gifts that you have given to us each day, new and fresh and wonderful. When we become cynical, when we become those who moan and whine and grump around, when, with all the best intentions, the pain that we feel, the things that we go through suck everything out of us, the hope and the joy and the life that you've come to bring. We ask, Lord, that you will restore to us the joy that is our strength. That you will give to us a vision, not just of the future D-Dar day in all its glory, but many such moments breaking into our existence day by day when we celebrate your goodness and your life on our own, in our families, amongst our friends, and together as your people. Lord, may we be a D-Dar day people for your glory. Amen.